coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. On today's Worth Doing Badly, we will look at the lessons for the 15th Sunday after Pentecost, according to Series B of the 3-year series lectionary. And they are Deuteronomy 4 verses 1 and 2 and 6 to 9, Psalm 119 verses 1 to 9 to 136, Ephesians 6 verses 10 to 20, and Mark 7 verses 14 to 23. We begin with Ethan Stoppenhagen, followed by comments and questions from David Weber.
I had a tough time with this group of readings. There was just something about their... In some ways, there was a disconnectedness, and it took a while to... In my mind, at least on the front side of things, but it took a while to sort of pick through things and find all of the connecting points that weave all of these readings together. And you know, and we make the point week after week that it's not, the sermon isn't about making sure all of the texts are brought into the sermon and that every word is exposited, but there's got to at least be a recognition that of how these other readings serve the gospel and the proclamation, particularly of the gospel. And in some ways, the true content of the sermon on the gospel lesson can be found in the other readings. And that's, I think, finally what happened for me is the other readings unlocked this gospel passage, because on the, by appearances, the gospel reading is just about clean and unclean, that which is that which defiles a person and that which doesn't. And Jesus here is continuing his debate from last week with the Pharisees, who had accused the disciples of eating with unwashed and unclean hands. And Jesus points out that they're, in their effort to master the law, the Pharisees had actually left behind the law and establish their own tradition. And the way I see this then sort of laying itself out is that Jesus is presenting us with two different approaches to religious life, two different ways of living with God. On one hand, you have the Pharisees who are concerned about protecting the law and becoming masters of it. And on the other hand, you have Jesus who's concerned about protecting the soul and pursuing understanding, which, as opposed to mastery, is engaged in humility. It's humbly engaging the heart and mind as the law, as the commands of God, as the promises of God are being spoken to us. And wrapping this into the conversation then about clean and unclean is where it gets difficult.
Why does defile have such potency for Jesus and for the Pharisees, whereas I have to say, clean and unclean doesn't do the same thing, you know, emotionally to me. It's not a metaphor that I naturally warm to. Did you discover anything about why defile is such an important category?
When he says defiled or things that are unclean, The base word there is koinoi, you know, as in koine, Greek. Uh-huh. You know,
yeah.
It's not necessarily defiled. It's simply it's common. Rather than being sacred, it's profane. So I think what you have here, at least in this context, is going to be attachment to life in the temple, perhaps, that you can't, you're not going to be able to have access to the temple if you have been interacting with things that are unsanctified.
Oh, that's helpful. So defile is the thing that separates us from being able to be in the presence of God.
Exactly.
Okay. Right. I mean, all right. So that makes more sense. And then what I liked about this is that when Paul Paul is saying, no, you're majoring on minors, and every time you major on minors, then you neglect what's really important, right? Or C.S. Lewis talks about how in every age, people do the very opposite of what they need to do. So in an age of materialism, people start warning about being too spiritual, right? And so there's this image of which, the problem is that everyone's on the right side of the boat, so you fix it by getting more people on the right side of the boat, right? And so we're very clever at neglecting the real problem that we are to confess, and that's what I like. What Jesus says, the upshot of being defiled is that we are unwise. We lack right. understanding. We lose our grasp of reality. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, like the Pharisees, they lost their grasp of reality, and they would focus on ridiculous things like how you washed your hands, when in fact, Jesus was saying, no, the more important question is, how do you get a clean heart? So that's my question to you is, how does this passage address the desire for this freedom that the passage creates?
The freedom that Jesus gives us isn't the easy way out, because he's going to push us to away from misunderstanding to understanding. So when he calls the 12, he calls the 12 out, that are you also without understanding? That word is actually relatively rare. It's only used once in Mark, once in Matthew, and a couple times in Romans. And it means, not just without understanding, but even dull or foolish. And literally, the word asunetos means unable to put together.
Huh.
So things have fallen apart. And the disciples, through Jesus' teaching, are supposed to be able to piece it back together. And they have not developed that ability yet. So part of, answering that concern, how do I gain freedom from, whatever these besetting sins might be, is learning to understand, to grow an understanding, to be able to put things back together with, with eyes turned towards Christ, that he's here to sanctify us with his word, with his spirit. And it's through hearing that word, perhaps not through the mouth are we defiled, but it's through the ears that we are sanctified when we hear the word and then take that word and engage it.
This is very inspiring, Ethan, that Jesus' salvation is then the capacity to put things together. We like the word telos, that the world is actually moving towards a point. It's not moving towards fragmentation. And to be able to see that in the particular, and this is what I love the liturgical passage, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be. So the beginning was good, the end is good, the is now, this understanding is the capacity to see that the goodness of the beginning is also becoming the goodness of the end, even while we live in this, that long list of fragmentation that Paul gives, with the evil thoughts and sexual immorality. But I want to go back to something else, which is characteristically un-Lutheran. If I was hearing this, I am interested in the Christian life. I like the Christian gospel, but I like the way that when you believe the gospel, it promises to make changes in your life. And as we were reading through this list of evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, I was just thinking of all of the creative literature and contemplation on what Christians have given, knowing that Christ intends to free us, but he doesn't give us all the means, right? And you just look at all the ways of people struggling, but this struggle against these things hasn't been diminishing of the person. It has been a source of monstrous creativity, beautiful creativity.
Right.
Again, I'll go back to the book by Tom Holland, Dominion. In however number of pages, 500 pages, he spells out how this struggle over centuries produces art and music and community and, you know, all the things which are the opposite of these fragmenting, defiling things. So
connecting it to the creative process, essentially, you know, we'll never become masters of our sins necessarily. You know, there's only one Lord of our sins who has mastered and taken the devil captive. And so those sins sort of serve us, and like you said, lead us to that so that we become masters of other things, the masters of the material world, so that they give life to, give life to the gospel, add to that proclamation. Do you think there's something there? That was just an idea that flashed in my head.
Yeah, when you were saying this, I was just trying to think, run through. And the most outstanding example of this creative energy is Augustine. And his confessions continue to be read and studied. And it's 13 books of the most remarkable contemplation of reality, because he believes two things. He believes that confession is confession of sin, and in response to that, it's confession of Christ's forgiveness, right? Those two things, as he made sense of his life, as he took the fragments of his life and put it together, it made this beautiful reading of what it is like to go through life with a double-edged sword of confession. We never, ever outlive or outgrow the confession of sin, because we are always sinners, as you said, right? But rather than seeing that as diminishing, that becomes a source of creativity and of, you know, of a certain energy of resisting the gravitational pull of sin to the common, to defilement. And the only reason for Augustine that he can be absolutely self-critical in some, you know, rather cruel ways to himself is only because he knows there's another meaning of confession, and that's confession of Christ as his Savior. And so I just think of one word, confession, in the mind of Augustine becomes, it produces a book that continues to be the source of so much a spiritual consolation and energy.
Thinking about that word confession, you know, it's, you know, literally you're saying together, right? So you're saying together really with God, right? You have received his words. You've received to use the language of the psalm, you've received his testimonies, and you're learning his language. And you're learning to speak that back to him, in a sense, to speak back to him as his words are being unfolded. Isn't that a wonderful passage there in the psalm? The unfolding of your words gives light.
And that's, again, a lesson that sadly I didn't learn fast enough, is that the words, especially even the words of a sermon, are not going to have immediate effect. In fact, I would be suspicious of words that have immediate effect. But the words are always in the process of unfolding. The words require contemplation, to chew on them. It requires time to let them sink in. And I'm sorry to say, it requires suffering for us,
right,
to really know the force of the cross, is that it becomes so real and palpable when we ourselves are in the midst of suffering. And that's why, you know, with the Old Testament lesson, why God warns that when things are good, be careful, because you'll forget what is truly important and you'll start focusing on the things which are unimportant.
You know, something about the psalm, though, that I think connects back to this idea of fragmentation is why is it that we generally, why do we draw a distinction between understanding the law, hearing God's words, and doing the law. Because in the Psalm, and even in the passage from Deuteronomy, it seems like they go together.
The law has to unfold, right? It says your testimonies are wonderful. That's not the first thing that happens when we hear the law. We bristle at the law, right?
Right.
But what we forget the fact is that God's presence is at work in our lives, and the things that we don't have to make the law our enemy. What we have to do is recognize that God is going to show the beauty of these words, right? And that's going to take some time. And, you know, I love the imagery of that we pant and, you know, we hunger and thirst for God's commands. Eventually. But that takes some spiritual groundwork. And again, it's the presence of Christ in our lives. That's the promise that promises to change these things. And I love the way the Psalm says it that happens because God is gracious, and the law shows itself to be part of that graciousness. So if in fact that intermediate step, that the affection for the law, you know, after the first proclamation, when it seems to prohibit what we desire, then we recognize that what we desire is not what we truly desire.
Right.
And then I think that third thing is it follows what Luther says. It follows like a good tree producing good fruit, is that there becomes this deep interest of how do human beings generally put this into action. But more, I think more impressive because of my reading of Kierkegaard is how do I as a single individual express the beauty of the law? You know, how does my life embody the wisdom of God's statutes? And it's always, it's going to do it ever so imperfectly, and it's going to be more of a desire than a performance. But it's to me, it's inspiring that God would invite us to participate in this life while we're living in the world. That again, that goes back to that list that Jesus is talking about of from the covetousness and greed, and that we're invited to live differently in this world. And I think there's a deep hunger. I see young people that I think they're wrong-headed about it when they criticize capitalism while enjoying all of the benefits of an economic system. But for them, they see the rot of making an economic system into a god, which people do, right? So they say they're anti-capitalist when in fact, I think they're hungering and thirsting for what Jesus says. No, it's not the stuff that's on the outside. It's not the material. But there is defilement. There is something which does undermine our connectiveness to God and to each other and to the world. And that is, you know, what we call sin. And as you said, we call fragmentation. So, you know, the beauty of this psalm, it hits all the right spots for me of the command, the desire for the command, and then the desire to incarnate the command.
And then in Deuteronomy, it sort of draws us out and see what's the result of that going to be, you know, when we hear the command and we keep them and do them, right? We hear the commands and do them. Deuteronomy says, that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples. So there's this wisdom gained from wrestling with God's commands as they're unfolding before us, that we are gaining wisdom through that and through, in some ways, through acting them out. And that is what gives us the understanding. So when Jesus, going back to the 12's lack of understanding, it's sort of what Jesus is pointing out there is perhaps their unwillingness or their inability to wrestle with what he's teaching. It's not that they have to completely understand what he's teaching. It's that they're totally missing that there's a conflict to begin with between the will of God and the will of man. And so Deuteronomy shows us what God says here is that we gain wisdom not by, you know, just by experiencing or by studying, It's through doing and through attempting to keep the law as God's words are unfolded.
My problem has always been to say those exact words, but I make them into weighty obligations rather than, as you have presented it, an inspiring invitation to participate in the love of God. And it's because I've doubted that God's will can be loved, right? Even though, you know, at my best times, I could actually say that this is more precious than gold, more, you know, sweeter than honey. Yeah, but for some reason, maybe it's just being, you know, of German stock or of Lutheran stock, I presume that the law is not sweeter than honey, that it's always this brutalizing hammer that destroys things. And as you've pointed out, these texts call us to a different relationship to God. I mean, that's what grace does. It changes that relationship. And once that relationship is changed, then our relationship to the law is changed. And, you know, to kind of jump the gun here, this is what I love about Paul's passage. He uses the image of the soldier or of the athlete. You know, these people wanted to be better at what they were. When you want to be better, when you want to be a good soldier or a good athlete, it's like wanting to be a good Christian. And it's funny that to want to be a good athlete sounds inspiring. To be a good Christian, you sound like all of a sudden you've ceased to enjoy fun and that you've just become a sourpuss about everything. But Paul's image of a good Christian is you know, one who is lightheaded with the joy of participating in the struggle, the agon, the games, you know, that and right. And what athlete would say, no, I would just like to be slower and weaker and dumber, right? Right. No one.
Yeah, Paul is really sort of urging us on. You know, we love this passage, right, because it's putting on the whole armor of God. But you do have to understand the imagery of what's behind that. And that's the, like you said, the imagery of the soldier who is constantly training and seeking to prepare himself for the fight. It's not like we just throw on the armor and stand there and wait. You know, it's a recognition that we are in a cosmic battle. And in my mind, you know, just using that word cosmic, you know, that we're fighting against rulers, against the powers over the present darkness, that ought to be inspirational, right? Because we know that the victory is already won in Christ, and that as we continue that fight, you know, we are just, you know, we're sort of riding on Jesus' coattails, but at the same time, you know, it's a very active and engaging fight because they're still trying to sweep us away from Christ. So we're always, you know, this imagery is something, like you said, that's very active, very vibrant, and that is a much more compelling understanding, I think, of the Christian life. Rather than just, you know, some meek and mild people sitting in the pew every Sunday. Instead, we are very active and engaged.
Here's the thought that crosses my mind. I really don't like the hymn Onward Christian Soldiers because it seems to misinterpret this passage where Jesus says it almost seems like our battle is against other people. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's oftentimes at the point of Reformation where we make the Catholics, you know, the thing that we stand against, where Paul is saying, no, this is spiritual warfare. Don't turn it into a materialistic, you know, battle of tribes. And this is what I love so much about that he uses the military image and he talks about the gospel of peace. You know, that this is, that this fighting, whatever this fighting is, it is something that brings human beings together. It's not flesh and blood fighting. It's against the rulers and against the authorities of the cosmic powers of darkness. It's so inspiring that, as you say, that our battles are not the petty battles we make believe our battles. Our battles are cosmic, and a long and in the long arc of time, they become important that we as individuals fight them. We may think it's futile. We may think nothing happens with our resistance to sin, but for some reason, there's an accumulative effect where Christians across the world desiring, you know, God's presence live in resistance to the things that defile that presence. Now you've made defile an important word in my vocabulary, and everyone's, and I'm going to overuse it probably.
Well, hey, I mean, if that gets the point across, and that's, you know, that's something I'll have to consider as going into preparing for writing this sermon is making that word have that new weight, you know, that people understand it's a separation from God's presence, and that by our being made clean, we are being brought back into that presence, and that everything is being put back together, that our fragmented lives are reordered in God.
I have the joy of being able to be retrospective on this thing, and I wish someone would have told me not to judge what you're doing, the goodness of what you're doing, by what happens on any given Sunday, right? And it seems these passages free a person to say the word unfolds over time, not according to a schedule on a Sunday. And I'm just wondering, how do you handle disappointment in yourself when the sermon has not done what you imagine it was supposed to do?
Part of it is looking back at the process. When I started experiencing, you know, some of that disappointment in preaching, I had to convince myself that the whole preaching task, the study and the preparation leading up to it, was just as much for my spiritual edification as it was for the people in the pew. I think we're told that, you know, the word gets proclaimed and it's for the people. It's all for the people, and that the pastor is just the mouthpiece, just the vehicle. But when I started experiencing that disappointment and sense of failure, I had to convince myself that there was still something in it for me, at least, even if the people weren't getting it.
Well, I think that makes sense. I'm never disappointed in the preparation. Just right. In the delivery of what I thought the gem of the gospel was. That's very helpful.
Thank you, David and Ethan. And thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.